Welcome to the Philosophy Cast, where we take complicated philosophical topics and break them down for everyone to understand so that we can gain new perspectives on the world. I'm your host, Alexander Chotai. Imagine for a moment that you're in France in 1685. The Edict of Nantes has just been revoked, and the few rights that Protestants previously had in France no longer exist. The French nobility is actively shrinking and being replaced with royal appointees based on the whims of the king. The French government is radically changing, and King Louis XIII is taking any and all measures to make the power of the king absolute. Why is this happening? It has to do with an idea, shared by Louis XIII and perfected by Louis XIV, that kingship is given by God. Now, let's jump back to today for a moment, so I can explain why I'm telling you this. This is the first episode of two installments, which will take a deep dive into the philosophical underpinnings of the state, specifically, what it actually is. But here's the problem. Many people disagree on what it is, and what it ought to be. So, I've decided to take a look at four distinct political systems/ideologies, and compare what they consider to be the definition of a state, quote-unquote. This episode will discuss absolute monarchism, otherwise known as absolutism, and the Enlightenment's response to it, in what is now known as classical liberalism. Next episode, we'll be taking a look at the view of the state in both fascism as well as Marxism. One could look at these two episodes as older ideologies versus newer ideologies, given that monarchism and the Enlightenment happened earlier in history than the advent of fascism and Marxism, as you know. As was stated, today we'll be taking a look at absolutism and liberalism, with a couple key characters in mind. In the absolutist corner, we have King James II of Scotland and Robert Filmer, who both wrote key works describing and defending the essence of the absolutist system. And in the classical liberal corner, we have John Locke, who is often considered one of the most influential fathers of not only classical liberalism, but of all modern political philosophy. We'll also discuss Thomas Hobbes, because of how influential Locke's strong distaste for his ideas would end up being on the Enlightenment. One last thing before we jump back into our scenario of early modern Europe. I want you to keep one word in the back of your mind throughout the entirety of today's episode. And that word is why. Specifically, you should wonder why our political landscape is the way it is today. Why do we have presidents instead of kings or dictators? Hopefully, gaining an understanding of the foundations of modern political philosophy will help you answer this question, and hopefully, that answer will reveal a lot of important things about the world around you. And with that, we return to using our imaginations. 16th century, Western Europe. Here, the aforementioned political ideology of absolutism is standard. In this system, which spanned all the way from Spain and France to Prussia and Austria, monarchs would hold endless power, with no checks or balances whatsoever. How did absolutism find its stranglehold over Europe? And, presented with a system that has no limits on governmental authority, we might ask too, how did people justify this? Nowadays, it's hard to imagine. We have checks and balances, democracy, and other such things which try their best to keep power in the hands of the people. What then allowed a country's entire population to simply accept that one man is the entire state? The answer is the divine right of kings. In its most basic form, the divine right of kings argues that the king was chosen by God himself. To challenge the king's authority was to challenge the will of God. Take, for instance, the argument of King James VI of Scotland, who wrote Basilicon Doron, a governmental treatise considered to be one of the most influential works on absolutism. King James ruled England and Scotland in tandem from 1603 to 1625, and was well known for the amount of power he brought to himself and the monarchy in general. So, let's start out our study of him with a quote from Basilicon Doron itself. In his book, King James claims that, quote, "The state of monarchy is the supremest thing upon earth. For kings are not only God's lieutenants upon earth and sit upon God's throne, but even by God himself are called gods." James came to the conclusion that monarchs were subject to no earthly authority whatsoever. To try to get rid of the king or to limit his authority is contrary to the will of God and is therefore sacrilegious. James also drew the parallel between a parent's relationship to their children and a monarch's relationship to their subjects. citing the fifth commandment, honor thy father and mother, as justification for the divine right theory. James said that, because any shortcomings or errors on the father's part don't necessarily give his children the right to dishonor him, that a monarch's shortcomings or errors don't necessarily give their populace the right to dishonor him. It's also worth mentioning the connection between the Catholic Church and the divine right of kings. The Roman Catholic Church asserted that the monarch was subject to both divine and natural law. If a monarch tried to overstep natural or divine law, the Catholic Church would then accept the illegal killing of the ruler, which, in the ideal case, would be ratified by the Pope. Of course, we now know that the words Catholic and Christian would not necessarily always be synonymous throughout history. Protestants, rejecting the Catholic perception of the Pope entirely, naturally have a different conception of the theory than Catholics do. Well, kind of. When King Henry VIII rejected the Catholic Church and the authority of the Pope, the Acts of Supremacy went on to state that King Henry was the King of England, not the Pope. He became both the head of England and the leader of the Church of England. Actually, it was after the Protestant Reformation that the theory of divine right started to take the form that we most associate with absolutism, where the king is God's representative on earth in both political and spiritual matters, subjected to and accountable to no one but God. With some history out of the way, we can now get to know our first proper political philosopher, Sir Robert Filmer. Although not much is known about Filmer's life, we do know that he was born in England, and that he is considered one of the most influential philosophers when it came to the doctrine of Christian absolutism. His best-known work, entitled Patriarcha, serves as his definitive justification for the absolutist model. So, let's start with that. Within the first few pages, we can see that, to Filmer, it seems that everywhere he looks, freedom is being justified with the argument that people are born with freedom from authority, and that government in any place really only exists because a group of people decided that it should. People also seem to be treating liberty from a government like something that should be maximized. Filmer wastes no time in getting into religion. He immediately invokes faith as an argument. Let us not forget that Christianity was basically the societal standard at the time, pointing out that in the Bible, Adam's desire for liberty to eat the forbidden fruit resulted in his destruction. Filmer begins his argument with a rebuttal. Filmer criticizes the arguments of Cardinal Robert Bellarmine, who argues that God had given power to mankind, but because all men are equal by natural law, that God couldn't have given power to any particular man. Therefore, God gave power to the people, or the multitude, as it is put. Filmer attempts to deconstruct Bellarmine's argument by using one of Bellarmine's very own claims against him. Filmer quotes Bellarmine as saying, "If many men had been created out of the earth, all they ought to have been princes over their posterity." The claim that Filmer is essentially making with his rebuttal is that fathers are monarchs who rule over their children. Filmer and Bellarmine both notice that according to Christian thought, Adam and all the fathers which had followed after that had what was essentially royal authority over their offspring. So, Filmer states that he, quote, "does not see how the children of Adam, or of any other man, can be freed from subjection to their parents, and the subordination of children is the fountain of all royal authority, by the ordination of God himself." Filmer goes on to claim that there are indeed no differences between the role of a father and a king, with the exception of maybe the size and scope of the two roles. To quote Filmer once more, "As the father over one family, so the king, his father over many families, extends his care to preserve, feed, clothe, instruct, and defend the whole commonwealth, his wars, his peace, his courts of justice, and all his acts of sovereignty, tend only to preserve and distribute to every subordinate and inferior father, and to their children, their rights and privileges, so that all the duties of a king are summed up in a universal fatherly care of his people." Filmer poses the question, did fathers get their authority from their children? No, Filmer says. Filmer claims that fatherhood never lost its authority. It has always existed. Therefore, Filmer argues, an absolute monarchy is the only system which makes sense. Okay, so, as has been made obvious by Filmer's writing, the Christian influence the absolutist model has is undeniable. As was stated before, the system relies on people to believe in Christianity in order for the system to work. Well, All you have to do now to realize that the system doesn't work anymore is to look at the West as a whole. We have presidents and prime ministers, not princes and kings. What changed? Simply put, society became secularized. In the West, we now see religion as a choice on the individual's part, not something an entire society, much less the government, adheres to. This shift in perspective first started making rounds as the Enlightenment swept across Europe throughout the 1700s. Pretty soon, it was no longer true that if you picked up a random peasant from the streets, that there was a pretty good chance they'd be praising the name of Jesus as opposed to another, or not at all. Why does religion matter in the context of perception of the state? Well, the intertwining of the church and state is one of the first things that Enlightenment philosophers went after in order to delegitimize absolutism. No religious uniformity, no monarchs ordained by God. Understanding the role religion played in the state and in society during this age of European history is crucial, because without it, the points of the philosophers we examine are devoid of very necessary context. So let's look at how the Enlightenment caused the pillar of society that Christianity once was in Europe to crumble. Had it become to more or less believe that religion is pretty much just up to you? Well, let's bring out our second political philosopher, John Locke. One of the most prominent philosophers of the Enlightenment, Locke laid out a case for religious freedom, which would end up being rather influential across the entire continent of Europe. Locke was born on August 29th, 1632, just in time for him to witness the bloody horror of an extremely violent fight between absolutists and anti-monarchists over the future of English government, later termed the English Civil War, by the time he was a child. In fact, his father served as a cavalry officer for the parliamentary, or anti-absolutist side, of the war. Locke's ambitions lay in science for a while, but he quickly surrounded himself with a crowd interested in politics and philosophy. He would frequently take part in various political discussions, and in 1689 wrote his first major piece of political material. The very appropriately named A Letter Concerning Toleration laid out the case for the state's toleration of various religions. Firstly, Locke pointed out that civil unrest was sure to follow from the government cracking down on diversity and religious beliefs. Unlike the more absolutist-leaning but not really absolutist Enlightenment-age thinker Thomas Hobbes, who viewed a uniform religion enforced by the state as the preventer of violence, Locke felt that diversity in religious beliefs, and furthermore the protection of diversity in religious beliefs by the state, was the key to societal peace, at least when it came to matters of faith. Locke's conception of the state was one that was fundamentally different from his conception of the church. The state, Locke claimed, should be concerned with preserving the life, liberty, and general welfare of its citizens, not with salvation or the well-being of the citizens' souls. That's the job of the church. Locke viewed the church and the state as two entirely different organizations and felt that they should be treated as such. Finally, Locke felt that no genuine belief would come from coercion into faith. A church, Locke argued, could only get true converts through persuasion, not violence. Locke summarized his points as such, saying that 1. Individuals cannot divest control over their souls to secular forces, as God does not appoint the magistrate. 2. Force cannot create the change necessary for salvation, because while it can coerce obedience, it cannot change beliefs. And 3. Even if coercion could persuade someone of a notion, it would not help with ensuring salvation, because there is no reason to believe that magistrates are reliable judges of religious truth. Locke went a step further, arguing that those who felt the state should persecute religions other than one's own should not be tolerated by the state. Locke argued that those who had such beliefs would attack the liberty and property of other citizens if they were given a chance to. Locke's writings on religious toleration influenced much of Europe. Religious persecution would become increasingly more rare. In England specifically, one's religious beliefs began to bear far less weight when it came to an evaluation of people as a whole. In relation to absolutism, Locke's advocation for religious toleration and other ideas which formed that what would become known as Enlightenment Age liberalism struck a heavy blow to absolutist rule. In particular, it united those who were opposed to the recent religious persecution of King Louis XIV of France, who pretty much was agreed to be the figurehead of absolutism. Locke was opposed to the absolutist system of government, obviously. The question that arises, though, What did Locke seek to replace the system with? The explanation begins with the philosophy of a man which Locke most disagreed with, Thomas Hobbes. Thomas Hobbes, like Locke, was around to see the English Civil War with his own eyes, although, having been born in 1588, he was far older than Locke when it began, in 1642. In university, he studied the principles of logic as well as physics. He soon came to be a tutor to many members of the Cavendish noble family. Quickly becoming a companion to the family's youngest son, named William, he went on a grand tour all around Europe. When he finally returned to his home country of England in 1637, he found it was racked with conflict and disagreement over how much power the king and parliament ought to have. He was witnessing what would evolve into the English Civil War. He became interested in philosophy for a while, but over time, he lost his interest in the field. His motivation to write philosophy finally kicked up again once the war actually broke out in 1642, when he found popularity amongst people loyal to the English monarchy, otherwise known as royalists, and was inspired to write his most famous work to date, Leviathan. Hobbes' political theory was influenced by his philosophical view of human nature, which was, to say the least, not a very hopeful one. Hobbes' theory of government is primarily contained in Leviathan, which starts off discussing a man in a state of nature, that is to say, people without any form of government or authority whatsoever. Hobbes argues that life in the state of nature would be poor. People would do whatever they wanted. Morality would essentially be decided by whatever advanced an individual's private interests most effectively. Society and security would essentially be impossible in this situation, Hobbes argued, stating, quote, "There would be no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation, nor use of the commodities that may be imported by sea. No commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death. And the life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short." Hobbes' rather abysmal view of people in the state of nature is derived from his belief that people, while compassionate, will always do anything that is necessary to secure one's survival in order to avoid one's death. Hobbes believed that people would function off of a right of nature, which was a right each person possessed that gave them the right to do whatever was deemed necessary to preserve oneself. However, as Hobbes saw it, practically anything could be deemed necessary for one's own preservation. So, Hobbes further termed this as the right to all things. Hobbes thought that the right of all things, people would employ whatever means necessary to reach their desired ends. Because of this principle, Hobbes calls the state of nature a state of war. The right to all things will inevitably lead to conflict because of the limited nature of resources and goods. People will fear invasion and will be paranoid of others, perhaps prompting them to strike first. Those who feel a need to have power will prompt others to employ defensive tactics against them. Differences in morals, religious beliefs, and what is necessary for one's preservation would only fuel conflict. With no central authority to resolve these conflicts, Hobbes certainly finds it appropriate to describe this situation as a state of war with every man for himself. Now, we could try to form groups with our families and friends which act in unison to try and decrease strife, but Hobbes points out that these groups will still have competition and strife within them, which can end up just as destructive as conflict outside of the group. Hobbes believes that only one way exists out of these bleak circumstances, a mutual demand for peace. Hobbes hypothesized that humans would come to see that peace is a desirable thing, and so that the means of peace would also be desirable. He believed that the means to peace would involve giving up part of our right to all things and agreeing to submit to a sovereign authority. To establish an authority, Hobbes thought that people would sort of mutually covenant to obey a common authority. When threatened, people would rely on this authority for protection, specifically by promising to obey a sovereign ruler. To Hobbes, what makes a government legitimate is not whether it came to power through democratic means, it's how well the said government can protect its citizens. The obligation to obey a ruler ends only when the government no longer protects its citizens from harm. Now, Hobbes' ideal system was, as you probably noticed, very similar to absolutism. Although not distinctly monarchical in nature, Hobbes did in fact argue that effective government must have absolute authority, with its power not limited. Hobbes thought that the government's effectiveness would be thwarted should it be curbed by anything at all. He opposed the idea of compartmentalization, which gives different rights to different bodies, as, should there be disagreement in what ought to be done, effective government would effectively be frozen, and a civil war would soon ensue. And, growing up in the midst of violence caused by the English Civil War, such a conflict was something Hobbes definitely wanted to avoid. In addition to these reasons, Hobbes felt that placing limitations on government made conflict over whether or not it had gone beyond these limitations at any given point inevitable. If it was left up to each person to decide whether the government ought to be listened to or not, war would be an almost guaranteed possibility. As was said, Hobbes, having seen the bloody and violent English Civil War with his own eyes, was desperate to avoid civil war, and furthermore, a return to the state of nature. With power relying in the hands of the state, and only the state, subjects were not responsible for the actions of their said power, because they didn't authorize the power to take control. Instead, people acted as more of an instrument of the sovereign. Now this assertion is something crucial. It's what Hobbes used to justify his system to his Christian readers, who would have likely suggested that submitting to laws which led them to sin was their action, and therefore they would be the ones held accountable for that action. Obviously, such a thought worries them, but Hobbes tries to put that and other possible counterpoints to rest by saying that whatsoever a subject is compelled to do in obedience to his sovereign, and doth it not in order to his own mind, but in order to the laws of the country, that action is not his, but his sovereign's. As we see here, Hobbes's philosophy is not a very hopeful one. He thinks that people, without a government telling them what to do, will attack, sabotage, and cheat each other, rather than being compassionate and seeking to help their neighbors. A government is born out of fear of brutality from our fellow human beings. We give institutions free rein over all of our lives in order to avoid chaos at all costs. Now, Hobbes's view of human nature led him to the near absolutist extreme, but Locke saw a different outcome for Hobbes's proposed state of nature. Now, before we talk about Locke's predicted outcome for the state of nature, it's best that we first cover his theory of natural law and natural rights. Natural law, the same kind spoken about earlier when we discussed the Catholic Church's stance on the divine right of kings, was the assertion that there were essentially moral truths that applied to all people, Christian or not. It could be discovered by anyone on their own, as opposed to divine law, which could only be discovered only through God and what God commanded. Locke wasn't entirely opposed to the notion of divine law playing a part in people's lives, so long as it was additive and not contradictory. Divine law was a fine concept to Locke, so long as divine law simply provided a stricter standard for living and didn't teach things outside of natural law. Now, onto Locke's theory of the state of nature. In Locke's second treatise of government, he defines the state of nature as, quote, men living according to reason, without a common superior on earth, to judge between them is properly the state of nature. So essentially, the state of nature exists when there's no political authority to settle disputes. Unlike Hobbes, Locke stresses individual consent as a mechanism by which individuals leave the state of nature into a political society. Locke even goes as far to say that one can only become a full member of society through explicitly consenting to do so. This is in direct contrast to Hobbes, who essentially argues that individuals have no choice but to submit themselves totally to a political authority in order to avoid transgressions against their preservation. The question that pervades Locke's theory is, how exactly do citizens give their consent to be ruled by their government? Locke's answer is his doctrine of tacit consent. By being within the borders of your nation, using its roads and living in its territory, you are giving your consent to your government to rule over you, and you are agreeing to obey the law of the land. In this theory, Locke thinks that resident aliens do, in fact, have an obligation to obey the government of the territory, because through them being in the country, they are giving tacit consent to the country's government. The inheritance of property, Locke argues, is an even more explicit and stronger indication of consent. The property's original owner put that property under the jurisdiction of the territory's government, and so therefore, children who inherit their parents' property consent to the government's jurisdiction of said property. Locke concluded from this, that owning property was the most explicit form of consent to a government, and so he placed the marker of becoming a member of society at that. With his defense of property, Locke theorizes that people would seek to enter into society which offered mutual protection of, quote, lives, liberties, and estates, which I call by the general name property. Locke then goes on to form his entire political outlook from this very claim. He states that the chief purpose of people putting themselves under government is to preserve their property, which is impossible in the state of nature for a few reasons. Firstly, the state of nature does not have a uniform, established, and known law received and accepted by common consent. Locke points out that the law of nature, or the law which people are supposed to figure out on themselves, doesn't really serve this purpose because we are self-interested and ignorant creatures. Secondly, the state of nature lacks a, quote, known and impartial judge with authority to settle all differences according to the established law. In that state, everyone is both judge and enforcer of the law of nature, and few men will play either role well. Locke realizes that in the state of nature, people both judge and enforce their verdicts. This doesn't work because we're always going to be favoring ourselves, such that things like passion and revenge can very well get the best of us. Finally, the state of nature lacks a, quote, power to back up and support a correct sentence and to enforce it properly. Locke points out that people who are guilty of crimes will desperately try to keep the benefits of their crime, often resorting to force to resist punishment to such a degree that makes punishment dangerous to those who try to carry it out. So then, it can be said that Locke's conception of the state is the protectorate of people's property. The state is the rightful user of violence and force, as opposed to men in a state of nature using it themselves. The right to essentially be one's own vigilante is given up when one enters political society, so Locke states that revolution is justified when a government threatens property. Now, while the liberal view of the state does depend on which philosopher is being discussed, I think Locke's description is a pretty good representation of it. While absolutism conceives of one man appointed by God as representing the entire state, the liberal supports separation of church and state, freedom of religion, and a government restricted by the conception of innate rights and separation of powers. Alright, but why does this matter? I mean, you can vote. You don't exactly see people wearing golden crowns and claiming their leadership was chosen by the heavens over on the Western Hemisphere, at least. Absolute monarchism is found hardly anywhere in the world, let alone in the West. It would appear that the topics of next episode, fascism and Marxism, don't exist in the West as they first appeared in Europe either. It seems that liberalism has largely won out over all alternatives, variations in structure and policies being the only real differentiator between Western governments. Well, the significance lies in the question, why, you should ask, why has liberalism won out? Answers vary. Some claim that representation of the people is what makes liberalism the best model. Others cite the failure of other systems as the main reason we keep liberalism around. Indeed, it has been said, Winston Churchill once remarked, that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. Some think that liberalism shouldn't have triumphed at all, while others struggle to find a better alternative. The debate surrounding the question is exactly why the arguments of it and its competitors are so important. We don't know how we came to arrive at the civil society we have today, and what the alternatives are. How can we expect to ever effectively act in it? To quote Churchill once more, the best argument against democracy is a 5-minute conversation with the average voter. Well, there's some doubt as to whether or not Churchill actually said that, but nevertheless, it's a sentiment many share. Many of us feel that our voter base really doesn't understand the system it's working with, and the only solution to this feeling is to educate ourselves on what is out there, not just in our country, our own hemisphere, but what was out there and what we can expect to soon return or come about in the future. Now, the significance question will make a lot more sense after a clearer picture is painted once we review Marxism and fascism. For now, though, let's not forget that the system we have today did not come out of nowhere. We went from a state which had one person to one made up of several. Let's consider that what we have now had to be fought for. Let's find out why it succeeded if we even personally believe it has succeeded at all. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next month when we review the conception of the state and the modern ideologies of fascism and Marxism. Until then, keep asking questions of your system and of the ones which have now faded into the past. Thanks for listening to the Philosophy Cast. We hope you learned something new or gained a deeper understanding of the world around you. Let us know what you think, and you can tell us your thoughts at thephilosophycast@gmail.com or at philosophycast.com. This has been Alexander Chotai, and I'll see you on the next episode of Philosophy Cast.